psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
We're glad you've tuned in for Dr. Bill Meyer Live, and we'll get to today's program in just a moment. First, an update on some faith news.
Mission Aviation Fellowship and New Tribes Mission are working hand-in-hand to deliver food, clean water, and other critical aid to remote island communities of the Philippines following the typhoon. MAF has 4 aviation personnel stationed in the Philippines, operating 2 small airplanes and 1 helicopter.
Once the storm had passed, we began using them to do survey flight to discover where the most damage has been so we could start aiding with the relief work as soon as possible.
Pam McCurdy says the team is focusing its efforts on small, isolated islands that no one else is assisting. John Woodbury is with MAF.
The islands we're serving have populations from 1,500 to 450 people. One person held the hand of our pilot with just tears in his eyes and thanking him. They couldn't believe someone cared enough to actually come.
He says some of the islands had 70 to 80% destruction.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome. It's so great to have you on this Saturday in the Upper Midwest, and we appreciate so much you taking Faith Radio with you wherever you are. We're just a few days away from Thanksgiving, and today we're going to be focusing on Thanksgiving and maybe some of the revisionist history that we've heard in recent years. Maybe even your child has read some things about Thanksgiving in his or her textbook that are inaccurate. We'll be talking to a historian who has researched this very carefully, is very familiar with the Pilgrims and what really happened on that first Thanksgiving, and that's coming up in just a few minutes here on Faith Radio. As you heard, our phone number is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, and you can call us. And if you call us this hour and give us your contact info, what we will do is put you down for a drawing, and at the end of the hour, we're going to give away 3 copies of 3 different books, 3 books written by today's author. So stick with us, if you would. That's coming up at the end of the hour. First, though, have a few ideas I want to pass on to you about Thanksgiving as we approach it. And I have found, I have 3 young kids at home, and I'm guessing if you're a parent, you are experiencing this as well. It's been difficult lately to help our kids feel thankful or grateful for what they have because we have such a materialistic, consumer-oriented culture these days. We're facing a real challenge in teaching our children to be grateful, because much of what they're seeing in the media is sending the message that our kids are entitled to everything they want. And right now, American kids, I think, have also come to believe that they should always get the biggest and the best of everything. So how do we cultivate character traits such as thankfulness, generosity, and self-sacrifice in our kids? You know, in 1 Thessalonians 5:18, the Bible tells us to give thanks in all circumstances, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. And if you read Luke chapter 12, Jesus says this: be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Wow, that is something that I think all of us need to reflect on. The abundance of his possessions. So many of us, I think, are being told by our culture that really what's most important is getting more stuff. And so how do we, in a culture like this, how do we help our kids to combat this cultural mindset? I think one of the ways we do it is by modeling a grateful attitude ourselves. And how do we do that? Well, I think we can verbally thank God on a regular basis, even for simple things like having a roof over your head or having food on the table. Show your kids that you are thankful by praying out loud and thanking God for the things you do have. And, you know, I found that thankfulness is something, it's a sure antidote for worry and anxiety. So that's one suggestion. Also, do your best to model gratitude in your relationships with your friends, with your relatives, with your coworkers, and not only when they do something special for you. Let other people know that you appreciate them simply for who they are, and express that kind of unconditional gratitude to your spouse and to your kids as well. And I think if we do those things, if we model those things, our kids may slowly but surely start to imitate us. And here's another idea for you as we approach Christmas. Help your kids learn to be more generous by serving others who are less fortunate. Your family might volunteer to serve Christmas dinner at a local rescue mission. Or how about this? Bake some Christmas cookies and call up a local nursing home and go in and visit the residents there and take them cookies and sing Christmas carols to them. Susie Larson, who you hear on Faith Radio Monday through Friday, has a great book on this topic. It's called Growing Grateful Kids. And let me just suggest to you, if you are struggling with this as a parent right now, you'll love this book. Susie just has some great ideas and some great biblical insights about helping our kids to learn to be more grateful and more generous. So you might want to pick that up this week. Well, it's 10 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer, and this is the Faith Radio Network. Up next, we'll be focusing on Thanksgiving, the real first Thanksgiving. What happened? What didn't happen? And who were the pilgrims? Stick with us as we talk to a historian who has really spent a lot of time researching this topic. Up next, here on the Faith Radio Network.
Isn't it strange how when we're disturbed over some family problem, we sometimes choose the most obscure or roundabout ways of saying so?
Here's Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
Instead of getting our feelings out in the open, we stall, we resort to silent hostility, or we lapse into a pity party. I saw a good cartoon recently that showed a double bed to which the wife had nailed vertical 2x4s to both the headboard and the footboard right in the middle. Then she'd strung barbed wire from one end to the other. She was depicted on her side of the bed with a scowl on her face, her arms folded, while her rather perplexed husband across the barbed wire fence was saying, apparently I've done something to upset you. There are better ways to get the message across. When an issue needs discussing, when the line of respect has been violated, we need to resist the temptation to pout, to sulk, or to sink into days of silence. That only prolongs the conflict and intensifies the pain. But how do we get our wounded pride out in the open to be healed by the fresh air and sunshine? Well, I found that writing one's feelings on paper is a good way to break the logjam and get the hurt partners talking again. The words can be carefully chosen and mixed with a little compassion. Like the man on the wrong side of the barbed wire, you might begin such a note with the phrase, "Apparently I've done something to upset you."
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com. MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. It's so great to have you with us. We are just 5 days away from Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving is our topic today. And we are very fortunate to be joined by Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He's a professor and the chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College. He teaches courses in U.S. history, the Civil War, and Dr. McKenzie is the author of 2 award-winning monographs, One South or Many, and Lincolnites and Rebels, A Divided Town in the American Civil War. Today he joins us to talk about his brand new book from InterVarsity Press called The First Thanksgiving. And Tracy, welcome to Faith Radio.
Bill, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Now, we are, as I said, just 5 days away from Thanksgiving, and in recent years, there's been more than a little controversy about how the first Thanksgiving has been portrayed in many public schools. Have the Pilgrims and Thanksgiving been given a secular rewrite in some modern history books, textbooks?
Bill, that's a good question. It's not something I've systematically studied in terms of the way textbooks today present the Pilgrims. I know that there is a tendency that's been going on, I suppose for the last generation, to present it in ways that I think the Pilgrims wouldn't necessarily have recognized. One of those ways, I think, is a tendency to present it as a kind of multicultural event. I mean, the Pilgrims, with regard to their relations with Native Americans, are usually either presented as sort of vicious, ethnocentric people who oppress the Native Americans, or they're presented as 21st century multiculturalists, a kind of early success story of cultural interdependence. And I don't think either of those caricatures holds water.
So what was the relationship between the Pilgrims and the Native Americans?
Well, it was pretty complicated, actually. I tell my students that the epitaph on my tombstone will be the words, "It is complicated." But I think the reality is, the human story is complex, and particularly when an issue gets fraught with political implications like Thanksgiving does, we tend to gravitate toward oversimplified sound bites. And I think that's true on both, ends of the political continuum. As I said, the relationship was complicated. The landscape among the Native American peoples before the arrival of the Pilgrims had already been really sort of turned upside down. Primarily because of the introduction of certain diseases that had occurred toward the end of the 1500s and early 1600s. And although we don't know exactly the date, it's pretty clear that there had been epidemics ravaging the indigenous population in recent years before the Pilgrims' arrival, so much so that a lot of the tribes that were right in that area around Cape Cod had really been devastated. That was certainly true of the Wampanoag, which was the people who lived right in that vicinity of present-day Plymouth. And they were badly weakened and very vulnerable to certain tribes that had not been touched yet by the diseases. And all this meant that the Wampanoag saw the Pilgrims when they arrived potentially as a threat, but also potentially as an ally in their struggles with other Native American peoples in the area. And I think that ultimately gives the Pilgrims a little kind of leverage, because the Pilgrims clearly need the Wampanoag, but there's a sense in which the Wampanoag conclude that they need the Pilgrims also. So there is this kind of relationship that develops. I think it's a fairly pragmatic relationship ground on the fact that they need one another. And we can exaggerate and make it a little bit too warm and fuzzy, but it worked. And the reality is they enter into a kind of informal treaty in spring of 1621, and they observe it throughout the lifetime of everyone who have been involved, and there's really not going to be any conflict between whites and Native Americans in that immediate area for more than half a century. So In that respect, it's a success story.
Now, when the Pilgrims first arrived, and I seem to recall reading some of those early journal entries, there was a lot of fear and suspicion on the part of the Pilgrims when they heard the drums, or they thought they saw the Native Americans in the bush. Was there a paranoia? Because obviously these are people who had never come in contact with Native Americans. I'm assuming it must have been fairly scary for them.
I'm sure it was. I mean, you're right in that they didn't have any contact, any history to draw on in relations between the Native American peoples. And their, their expectations of what to encounter were pretty negative. Certainly, William Bradford is writing about their anticipation of moving to North America, and they expect that the people they encounter will be savage, that they will be prone to violence, if not very much that way. And so they're very concerned. There are some brief encounters early on. In fact, one of the first main encounters between the Pilgrims and Native American peoples, it's not with a Wampanoag, but while they're sort of exploring along the coast looking for a settling place, they do have a kind of violent encounter. Ultimately, no one is killed, but one of their first encounters had turned to violence. And so they are very, very circumspect in the way that they reach out to the Native Americans. And of course, if you're inclined to see the hand of God in the story, one of the details that seems so very striking is that they're able to enter into a relationship with the Wampanoag because there's at least two people living with the Wampanoag who speak English. And that makes all the difference in the world in terms of their ability to you know, to communicate why they are there and how they would hope to be able to coexist.
Okay, let's talk about those two Native Americans who did speak English. What do we know about them?
Well, we know most about one of them. One was named Samoset and the other Squanto, and that's the one that we know the most about. His full name was Tisquantum. But Squanto had been a member of a Native American tribe that lived in the area around Plymouth where the Pilgrims ultimately arrived. These areas had been visited by European fishermen many, many times before the Pilgrims arrived. We forget that there had actually been a history of pretty extensive interaction, but not permanent settlements. And so sometime between probably 1610 and 1615, there had been a European naval vessel touch ground at the area around Plymouth and had actually kidnapped Squanto and maybe 10 to 20 other members of that tribe, taken them back to Spain and sold them into slavery.
Mm.
So Squanto lived as a slave period of time in Spain. He ultimately is liberated through the intervention of some Catholic priests there. And the story is complicated, but he ends up being a servant in the household of a British sea captain in England. And when he has an opportunity to go with this sea captain back to North America, he does so. But when he arrives, he basically discovers that his particular tribe has literally been wiped out from disease. Mm-hmm. He's the last member of his tribe. And so he manages to enter into a relationship with a Wampanoag, but he is not a Wampanoag himself. And in fact, the chief of the Wampanoag, Massasoit, seems to be a little suspicious of him. For all practical purposes, Squanto is living sort of under house arrest, if you will, with a Wampanoag. But he has lived for several years in England, actually is quite fluent in English, and is able ultimately to serve as a kind of interpreter and does further the cause of harmony between the two groups dramatically.
And Samoset, who is he?
You know, I don't know as much. He had interacted some with European fishermen, but I don't think he had ever lived abroad. And his amount of command of language, at least according to Wim Bradford, was pretty minimal. But he's the first one who actually comes into their settlement around March of 1621. And as Bradford writes famously about him, he walks in wearing only a kind of loincloth, walks in among them and says, "Welcome, Englishmen." And it would have been, you know, as if you were doing an exploration of Mars and someone comes, a little green man comes from around a rock and speaks in your own language. It just totally stuns them. And it's Somerset that then says, you know, there's someone in my camp who speaks your language very well. They returned, the two of them together, a few days later.
Mm. You know, when you mentioned earlier God's providence, and it is quite remarkable that the Pilgrims would land at this particular place and that those particular Native Americans would be there who were able to communicate. Because if that hadn't occurred, you have to wonder, would there have been a very different outcome?
Well, absolutely. And, of course, God knows that. We don't know, but we would speculate. And there are a lot of different details that turn out to be crucial. I mean, even had the Pilgrims arrived, say, a decade earlier before the incidence of disease, the Wampanoag would not have needed the Pilgrims, and the numbers would have been vastly different than they were. And at least you speculate as to whether it would have been possible for them to enter into the kind of peaceful relationship that they did.
Mm.
So that's also a crucial detail. And then even just the fact that they are able to settle in an area where at one time there had been a thriving Native American settlement, it makes a great difference to their ability to be able to survive that first winter because they actually find stashes of corn that had been buried and then left when the people there had been wiped out. The land has already been tilled. You know, the ground has been broken, which is a very difficult chore, and so forth. So there are a lot of details that come together that, humanly speaking, seem to make the pilgrim survival possible.
Let's explore who the pilgrims were, because it's pretty clear from your book that you have great respect for them.
Sure, and I do have a great deal of respect for them. I think we often misunderstand them, but I totally think of them as role models myself. The pilgrims, just to sort of make this brief if I can, the pilgrims are a subset of a subset within the Church of England. The Protestant Reformation had eventually affected England, but in a different way than it had in the European continent. And ultimately, the Church of England that's established during the English Reformation still resembles the Catholic Church in some significant ways. So it still has a hierarchy of bishops, for example, still has retained a fair amount of the ritual and worship of the Catholic Church. And there's a group that develops in the Anglican Church called Puritans, who are pushing for further reform of the Anglican Church, and from their perspective, further purification of Anglicanism from Catholic influence. The Puritans generally thought that they could work within the Church of England, that they could sort of cooperate with the powers that be and eventually get the kinds of reforms that they thought were scripturally called for. There's a subset within that group that ultimately is called Separatists. And the Separatists had arrived at the conclusion, one, that this wasn't working, that working within the confines of the existing church was not leading to reform. But ultimately, they arrived at the conclusion that the Anglican Church was not even a true church. And they felt so strongly about that that they came to the conclusion that it was sin. Once they had arrived at this conclusion, it was sin for them to continue within the church, to listen to the teaching of Anglican priests, to fellowship with Anglicans. And so they believed that God requires of them to separate themselves. And so around the beginning of the 17th century, small groups of separatists will begin to worship in their own congregations. And when they do that, they are making themselves enemies of both the established church, but also of the state itself. Since Anglican Church was an established church, to defy it was also a crime against the civil authorities. So ultimately, that kind of defiance is what will lead them to experience some repression and persecution, and eventually lead many to leave the country.
And initially, they go to Holland, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's part of the story that we tend not to remember. Sometimes we paper over that. They leave exactly when it's not entirely clear, but it's probably in early 1608. They do go to Holland because Holland has a reputation, and I think it's a reputation that that is earned, of being a place of religious toleration. If you're willing to be peaceful and law-abiding and so forth, there's a lot of latitude for your religious beliefs. So they go first to Amsterdam and then eventually to Leiden, which is about 40 miles away, town of 40 to 45,000 people. And they're going to live there for about 12 years, and it's a mixed experience for them. The pilgrim writers that remember their time there are saying two things. One, in terms of religious environment, actually they do experience great religious freedom. And that's something that they appreciate, and they remember their congregation in one level is really thriving.
You're hearing that music?
I am, yeah.
that's our warning. We've got about a minute left. I'd love to unpack this more after the break. Because I think it is fascinating. It was a mixed experience for the pilgrims. Why didn't they stay in Holland, and what ultimately made them decide to go to the New World? Our guest is Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He is the professor and chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College, and he has this phenomenal new book on InterVarsity Press called The First Thanksgiving. This is a book for, I think, any Christian's library to learn about this monumental event in the history of our country, and I would highly recommend it to you. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Here's what's ahead on the next Connecting Faith.
Navigating cultural changes is an ongoing reality for the church. How we find our way through these challenges is the topic of the next Connecting Faith. We'll talk with author and pastor James Emery White about two of his recent books, The Church in an Age of Crisis and Christ Among the Dragons, Finding Our Way Through Cultural Challenges. Join us for a prescription of hope and truth on Connecting Faith.
Listen for Connecting Faith weekdays at noon on Faith Radio.
Faith Radio's mission is to lead people to Christ and nurture you in your spiritual growth through Christ-centered media. We recently connected online with David from Bangladesh.
I'm so glad to have been introduced to MyFaithRadio.com. I like to listen to Faith Radio, which I get through this address online. It's my wish that God will expand His ministry everywhere in the world.
MyFaithRadio.com crosses borders and even oceans. Log on today at MyFaithRadio.com and join the conversation helping to spread the message of Faith Radio.
University of Northwestern, St. Paul, your life on purpose.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest this hour is Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie, professor and chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College. And Tracy has written this excellent new book called The First Thanksgiving, What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. And I'm just going to brag on you for a second, Tracy, because Mark Knoll at the University of Notre Dame says, Tracy McKenzie's clearly written and thoughtfully accessible book should be read with appreciation by a wide audience. It combines solid historical treatment of early American Thanksgivings with a perceptive understanding of historical method in general, and it does so by understanding the profound Christian stake in history. It is one of those rare books that is perfectly suited for young readers, but also of real value to those of us who've been around for a long time. Wow, those are some nice words.
They are. I am honored to hear that.
Well, you've received some great endorsements on this book, and obviously it's been a labor of love for you. We were exploring the Pilgrims, the separatists within the Puritan movement, leaving the Anglican Church. Some felt very strongly that the church was really not a biblical church at all, and that it would have been sin to remain in the Anglican Church, and so they wanted to separate and pull out. And at first they went to Holland, which practiced a lot of religious tolerance for that day, and they had somewhat of a mixed experience there. Tell us what happened to the Pilgrims in Holland.
Sure, and I'll try to be very brief. The gist of it is that in terms of their ability to create their own congregation and worship as they believe the Scripture taught them, they actually have no complaints whatsoever and remember that time in Holland very positively in that regard. They do complain in other ways, or there are obstacles that they do refer to. One is economic. They're largely a rural people that have relocated to one of the most urban areas in the Western world at that time. And they are put effectively to doing what today we'd call piece work. They're working in their own homes in the textile industry for the most part. That's the most common way we believe that they're earning their living. So they're working from dawn to dusk, 6 days a week, to eke out a living. They're living in homes that would be, for our standards, just ridiculously small, somewhere between 200 to 300 square feet all told. And Bradford is saying it's a severe existence. It's so very difficult on the elderly. It's very difficult on our children. He says our children are growing old before their time, and many of them are being discouraged and ultimately leaving to try to find opportunity elsewhere. So that's one thing that troubles them greatly. They also believe that the Dutch culture is too liberal in terms of its practices, and they think that it's having an adverse effect really on their children, and that troubles them as well. So when they ultimately decide to consider leaving, they're hoping to find a new home, certainly where they'll have religious freedom, as they understand it. But they already do have that. So it's more accurate to say they want to continue to have it, not that they're fleeing a place where they don't have it. But they want to add to that religious liberty, hopefully, an environment that will afford a less arduous living, and also give them the freedom just to live among to themselves and to raise their families without sort of the adverse effect of the surrounding culture.
So what causes them to consider the New World? Was it Bradford's leadership?
Bradford actually is not the leader at that time. There's a man named John Carver who's very important. He's going to be the first governor of the new colony, but he's going to die of a stroke early in the first year that they're there. John Robinson is the main pastor of the Pilgrims Congregation in Leiden. He seems to have been influential. One of their deacons was a man named William Brewster. One of the things that's interesting, and we do learn this from the Pilgrim writings, is that when they began to consider relocation, they consider a lot of areas, including some areas controlled by other European powers. They consider going to South America for a while, and it seems like they are quite serious in considering that as a possibility. But ultimately, they know that they need to have governmental approval wherever they go, and they're able to, through sort of friends of friends, be able to make a connection with a company that had been chartered by the British king called the Virginia Company, which James I had authorized to oversee settlement in the British areas of North America. And that is why ultimately they decided to settle in that area.
And there was wasn't there a deal with that Virginia Company as far as, obviously, the Virginia Company was in it for profit, as was the king. What was the deal they made with the Pilgrims?
Well, the Virginia Company is simply a company that's been chartered to oversee settlement in the British areas of North America. And they simply want anyone to live there that they can because they're trying to generate a population to sustain the colony. I think what you may have in mind is the Pilgrims also need someone to help bankroll their venture, to help them deal with the great expenses of relocating. And here they enter into an agreement with a group of London merchants headed by a man that William Bradford comes to despise ultimately, named Thomas Weston. And these merchants are entering into an agreement with the Pilgrims, basically in which the merchants will pay for the cost of relocating. They'll pay, at least they're supposed to, for supplies that would sustain the Pilgrims until they are themselves self-sustaining. And in return, the Pilgrims will work for a period of 7 years for the company, putting everything that they generate in terms of revenue into a common fund. And from that common fund, the merchants are going to be paid back with interest. Anything that's left over then is going to be divided among all of the parties. So the London merchants that are bankrolling this are clearly expecting to make a profit. And it's interesting, again, another tale we don't remember, that the way that they expect that the Pilgrims will generate revenue is actually not agriculturally, it's by fishing. Mm. Those areas off the coast of New England are renowned at the time for sort of rich fishing banks, and they expect that these Pilgrims will generate money that way. And so it's interesting, the Pilgrims who had started out as a rural people ended up weaving cloth in Leiden, they're now supposed to be fishermen in New England, and they have no experience or background in that at all.
You mentioned that William Bradford comes to despise this group of merchants. What happens?
Well, their relations get pretty estranged pretty quickly. And Weston sort of unilaterally changes the terms of the contract even before they get ready to leave for North America. Later, when the Pilgrims, that first winter, you know, and the Pilgrims are going to suffer devastating losses. One half of their number are going to die. And Weston is just sending them letters saying, where's the goods? Where's the money? You know, he accuses them of being lazy and whining and so forth. And then he just cuts off. He doesn't provide any more supplies after about the first 6 months or so of the agreement. And Bradford actually writes, this is 25 years later, but he says, I'm just so reminded not to put our confidence in man.
Wow.
And he really feels that he'd been abandoned by this financier.
Mm. Talk about, if you would, the Pilgrims' religious beliefs, because some of those have maybe been misinterpreted in recent years. You mentioned they were separatists. They wanted a pure faith. What are some things about their practice of Christianity that you really appreciate?
It's a great question. I'll start with just a little bit of clarification. We want to remember when we're talking about the individuals who come on the Mayflower and create the settlement at Plymouth that some number, probably a half to two-thirds, were part of the congregation at Leiden, and the remainder were individuals who were actually recruited by these financiers, more profit-oriented financiers in England. We know much less about their values, but if I could just speak to that group that had originated from that Leiden congregation, they are devout Protestant Calvinists, among other things. That means that they take the sovereignty of God with great, great seriousness. They see God's hand in all of life, and certainly in every good thing, which comes down from the Father, as the writer of James says. They read their scripture very, very strictly. They adhere to what theologians, I guess, today would call the regulative principle, which means effectively that anything that is not clearly prescribed in scripture, they're very hesitant to embrace. And one of the ways that we see that manifested is in their attitude toward holidays. They believed that the Catholic Church had created a large number of holidays that were really just human inventions, and they felt that the scripture actually authorized very few holidays. And some of this shocks us. They found no scriptural foundation for Christmas, and since there was no clear scriptural injunction to celebrate Christmas, they thought it was wrong. They didn't celebrate Easter because the scripture doesn't identify which which Sabbath would be the one or which Sunday would be the one of Christ's resurrection, and they say there's no scriptural command to honor one Sunday above any other. So they actually are very, very strict about that. One other thing I would say about their theology, which I think challenges me very much and probably would challenge many of us, they are so, I think, clear about the nature of their identity and where their hope lies, where their citizenship is. We lose sight of the power of this phrase, pilgrim. It's just a label that we use for these people who come over on the Mayflower. But when William Bradford refers to the group as pilgrims and says that they knew that they were pilgrims, he's thinking of the 11th chapter of Hebrews, where the writer there is talking about that great list of heroes of the faith, says that they are strangers and pilgrims in this world. And so Bradford was saying that the Leiden congregation understood that the world was not their home, that their ultimate future and hope lay in heaven. And I think that was a kind of context, a kind of lens through which they interpreted everything that happened to them in this world.
It is a great challenge for us, Tracy, in this day in which we're so often caught up in the trappings of, the daily life and so many things that are, I think, maybe steering us away from what God would want us to do and how he'd want us to live. We can take, I think, be great inspiration from their writings and from the way they actually lived. We are talking to Dr. Robert Tracy McKenzie. He's a professor and chair of the Department of History at Wheaton College, and he's written this great new book called The First Thanksgiving: What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. It's 43 minutes past the hour, and up next we are going to explore what that first Thanksgiving really entailed and what the maybe modern-day history books don't tell us about it. And also we have three copies of Tracy's book to give away. If you give us a call right now, 877-93-FAITH, give us your contact info. At the end of the hour, we will have a drawing for a copy of The First Thanksgiving. I'm Bill Meyer. We'll be back after this quick break here on the Faith Radio Network.
You know, we receive many thank yous throughout the year. Notes from listeners whose lives have been changed by, well, the messages of timeless truth from relevant Bible preachers and family-focused teachers. But those expressions of thanksgiving also belong to everyone who helps keep Faith Radio on the air. If you're not already a member of the monthly support team that keeps Faith Radio on the air, would you consider joining this Thanksgiving season? You can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com. Thank you.
It's not just information, it's transformation.
A lot of things have kind of gone on in the last year or so, the last few years actually. I just needed something different, just kind of was poking around and I found it. The reassurance that the Lord is there with me, listening to the messages all day long, it brings peace to my day. Not only that, I mean, I've been educated. He's there all day, all the time.
Connecting faith to life every day. Thanks for listening to Faith Radio.
How would you describe Faith Radio?
It's inspiring.
It really challenges me.
It gives me that nudge I need in the right direction.
We'd be honored to hear why you'd listen and why you'd recommend Faith Radio to friends and loved ones. It's simple to share your story. Just call our Faith Line and leave a message with your story. The number is 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. Then press 2 for the Faith Line. And thank you for sharing your story on the Faith Radio Faith Line.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. So great to have you with us today. My guest, Robert Tracy McKenzie, professor and chair of Department of History at Wheaton College, the author of this new book, The First Thanksgiving. Here's what Christianity Today says about this book. If you want to rediscover the first Thanksgiving and learn what difference studying history makes, well, you couldn't do better than reading this one volume. By looking at the pilgrims afresh, they come alive and remind us how we mean to live and do not yet live. Tracy, we were talking about that before the break, reading about the pilgrims' lives and their practice of the Christian faith can be a real challenge to us.
Absolutely, and it ought to be, I think. One of the dangers, snares that we can fall into is we can sort of imagine the pilgrims as simply being just like us, and we relate to them in that way, but they don't really challenge us. And I think the pilgrims, if we really understand them fully, will challenge us greatly. And one of the main reasons I wrote the book, actually, is that I think there are things that they can say to us that we need to hear.
Now, as we've mentioned in some textbooks in recent years, the pilgrim's faith has been downplayed or ignored pretty much altogether. Is that intentional? Is that just a product of a secular academy? What's going on there?
You know, it's hard for me to say, Bill, what I have read from individuals who have systematically studied the place of religion in public school curriculum. The way that First Thanksgiving might be treated is not unusual, and there's probably, I suppose, a variety of reasons why that is so. One of the things that I would want to say is that there's enough in the pilgrim story, if we really engage it honestly, to challenge secularists and Christians. And I think it's good for us to be honest about the role of religion in the pilgrims' lives. And as I've tried to suggest, it's absolutely central. It's pervasive. They see all of life as an expression of the sovereignty of God over them. And it's sort of absurd to try to understand their worldview with that removed. Having said that, I'll just share this a little to nudge our Christian audience a little bit. I think we can go back to the pilgrims simply to find that kind of evidence so that we can use it as leverage or ammunition against our culture and say, see, aha, these important figures were believers. And to some degree, what we're saying is, see, they were just like us. But the truth is, they have a lot that would challenge Christians, as well. And one of the ways that I think that they would challenge Christians, it's a little unpopular to say this, but they were very skeptical of holidays. And I think we need to keep that in mind. They don't have any authority over us, and they're not automatically right, and I don't think we necessarily have to be persuaded by their, you know, their regulative idea that unless the scripture authorizes it, it is never acceptable. But they did believe that regular holidays had a sort of inherent danger of becoming empty rituals. And certainly they thought that that was the case in most of the kinds of holidays that they associated with the Catholic Church or even with the Anglican Church. And I would just say, you know, as we're thinking about our own celebration of Thanksgiving, we can look at our culture and say, is Thanksgiving a meaningful event, or is it something that's become more or less an empty ritual? And I'm not going to answer that for you, but I think it's a question that we all need to ask about in our own practices and the state of mind that we bring. And then just finally, I would add, I think they saw Thanksgiving as a state of mind more than as a single event. And that's a kind of word of challenge I think we need to take seriously.
Great challenge for all of us, and as we move towards Christmas as well. Empty holidays?
Yeah.
And Black Friday, my gracious, you look at the way the media, Thanksgiving now, many of the major retailers are going to open on Thanksgiving night the shopping spree.
Yeah, so. That depresses me. I heard you speaking to your listeners about ways to promote attitudes of thankfulness among the children and our families generally, and I think there's a way that we can learn from the pilgrims, and one of the things that I try to argue in the book is there are things that we can learn from them, not just in November, but sort of all the year round. I think if we took seriously their idea that Thanksgivings can be offered irregularly, not just at the end of the harvest or, as we think, at the very end of November, but throughout the year. I was thinking if I had done my research on the pilgrims when my family was young, I think what I would have taken away is this opportunity as the governor of my home to issue, you know, I put this in quotation marks, proclamations of Thanksgiving at different times throughout the year. Anytime I could identify a sort of an extraordinary blessing, you know, set aside a day and declare it Thanksgiving in your family and say, God has been kind and we're gonna celebrate. And I think that would create a kind of attitude of expectancy throughout the year, not of entitlement, but of expectancy as we think of the ways that God intervenes graciously for us, as opposed to it being a kind of obligatory thing we do once a year.
Mm. Boy, it's a great challenge to me. I have three young children at home, 10, 8, and 6, and you've just given me something to prayerfully consider, and so thank you for that, Tracy. We've just got about 6 minutes left. Let's focus on that first Thanksgiving celebration. And was it all about thanking the Indians for their help? Was it about thanking
God?
The
answer is sort of complicated. It wasn't about thanking the Indians. In fact, one of the things that strikes me about the mythology that's emerged about the Thanksgiving is the absolute certainty we have today as a culture that the pilgrims invited the Native Americans. There's no clear indication that that was so. We know that Native Americans were present, but we know from other writings that they basically were in the habit of coming uninvited quite regularly. And so we just don't know. And the evidence says only that the Indians came amongst us, is what one pilgrim writer says. So no, they weren't holding this as a kind of banquet, inviting the Native Americans to thank them for their help. It certainly was a religious gathering in the sense that any time the pilgrims gathered and any time they were celebrating good things, they saw that as from God's hand. They probably didn't see it as a holy day, however, I would say that. They also thought of Thanksgiving holy days, which were days centered around worship and often fairly solemn celebration. And this doesn't really have that feel. You have a sense of an outdoor celebration. But it certainly was, as all of life was, infused with religious significance.
And tell us about that meal. And actually, was it more like a 3 or 4 day celebration?
It certainly was a multi-day celebration. Again, we have to speculate just a little bit because the evidence isn't precise. But if you want an image in your mind's eye, think 4th of July, more than what we tend to associate. That is to say, it was outdoors. It was a community gathering. It wasn't centered in the home. It would have been a community gathering outdoors. Wipe the image of those long tables out of your mind. Pilgrims didn't have any furniture at all, really, at that time, and not much in the way of cooking utensils. So they would have been seated on the ground. They would have been eating with their hands. Everything they would have eaten would have been boiled or roasted because they didn't have ovens yet. They didn't have sugar. They didn't have flour. So there had been a lot of meat, a little bit of vegetables. The meat probably didn't include turkey. I hate to say that. But there's not much evidence of that, and in fact, some evidence against that. A lot of waterfowl in the area, so ducks and geese and swans. We do know that the Native Americans brought deer, so there was venison. We also know that the creeks around Plymouth were full of eels. That's one of the things that Squanto had taught the Pilgrims to do, is to dig eels out of the riverbeds, and William Bradford says that they were fat and juicy and sweet.
Oh please.
And in terms of trimmings, they had in their gardens what they called salads, which would have been greens like collards and turnips and parsnips. So I tell my students, if you want an authentic Thanksgiving, have turnips and eels, and you're probably closer than turkey and dressing.
I'm sorry, that just made my stomach go someplace I don't
know. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Oh, gracious. Tracy, we're just about out of time. In your book, you call attention to the first Thanksgiving we don't remember. What are you referring to there?
Just real quickly, in keeping with the idea that Pilgrims thought of Thanksgiving as a regular thing and a very solemn thing often, in 1623, 2 years later, almost 2 years later, they experience a great drought that threatens really just to destroy their crops and really threaten the life of the settlement. They have a day of humiliation and fasting where they pray all day and beseech the Lord's deliverance from this drought. And one of the pilgrim writers says that a day that began sunny and clear, by the end of the day had clouded over, and during the night a gentle rain begins to fall that falls without interruption for 2 weeks.
Mm.
And so they declare a day of Thanksgiving in July of 1623. We never remember that. A day of Thanksgiving for God's provision of rain and deliverance from that drought.
Wow, that is very, very powerful.
It is powerful.
Did not know that. Well, as we wrap up, Tracy, any final thoughts on how Christians today can learn from the Pilgrims and their experience on that first Thanksgiving?
I think the most important thing is simply the mindset that the Pilgrims have, one which is to see God's kindness in everything that's provided throughout the year. And then this other is just their identity. There's such clear sense of who they are as pilgrims, as strangers, as travelers through this world, that I think just informed the way that they looked at all of life.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you for this wonderful book, obviously a labor of love for you and highly endorsed by many historians. It is, once again, the first Thanksgiving. What the Real Story Tells Us About Loving God and Learning from History. It's available from InterVarsity Press. You can learn more about the book at ivpress.com. Tracy, thank you so much. May the Lord continue to guide and direct you in both your work at Wheaton and your writing.
Thank you, Bill, and happy Thanksgiving to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. Our guest, Robert Tracy McKenzie from Wheaton College. I'm Bill Meyer, and that wraps things up for today. We thank you for joining us, and I would echo what Tracy said. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family, and may you learn from the story of these early Christians and put into practice Thanksgiving and thankfulness all year long. We'll see you next week.